Hello, and welcome to the Comics Ate My Brain Weekly Roundup Podcast. I'm Tom Bondurant, and this week we'll be talking about Batman and Robin number 3, Blackest Night Titans number 1, Detective Comics number 856, Fantastic Four number 570, Flash Rebirth number 4, Gotham City Sirens number 3, Green Lantern number 45, Madame Xanadu number 14, Superman number 691, Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen Special number 2, Unknown Soldier number 11, Wednesday Comics number 8, and Wonder Woman number 35. Since there are so many books this week, we'll just knock out a few of these up front. First is Unknown Soldier number 11, written by Joshua Dysart and drawn by Alberto Ponticelli. This is the latest chapter in the Easy Kill arc, and it focuses on Moses' wife, Sera, S-E-R-A, ongoing pronunciation troubles, of course. Anyway, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a nice way to bring the major players in this arc together, at least narratively, check in with them, check in with Mr. Hal, the CIA agent who's popped up occasionally, and introduce a new character who is not entirely welcome, I'm sure, to Moses's wife. The book is good as always. I will have to go back and look at issue 10 to remind myself just exactly where everyone is at the beginning of this issue, but I continue to enjoy this series, and this was another quality installment. Next, Fantastic Four number 570. This is the first issue by new writer Jonathan Hickman, new penciler Dale Eaglesham, and new inker Paul Mounts. And if I had to say one thing about this issue, is it lacks the attitude of the Mark Miller, Brian Hitch run. That's not really a bad thing, if you remember what I had to say about the Mark Miller and Brian Hitch run. But it does produce a book that feels a little unsure of itself. Eaglesham's and Mounts' work reminds me really of when Paul Pelletier and Rick Magyar were drawing the book and Dwayne McDuffie was writing it. It's decent. I don't dislike Dale Eaglesham. I thought he was good on the Villains United miniseries. I wanted to call it Secret Six. And I thought he was good on the Justice Society book, what little I read of it. And he and Mounts are fine here, but Hickman starts off, as a lot of FF writers do, focusing on Reed and sort of how Reed is driven. I guess I'm got a problem. This has turned into a longer summary than I thought it was going to be. I guess I got a problem with how Eaglesham draws Reed. He draws him a little too beefy for me. The bulk of the story concerns the wizard, the wingless wizard, as he was fond of calling himself. But it's really another story, about how Reed is constantly trying to fix everything and, have everything in the world running smoothly. And quite frankly, that's a road that we went down around the Civil War crossover, and it's something that Dwayne McDuffie addressed as well. And, I'll always read Fantastic Four, I guess, out of affection for the characters. So I'm a little disappointed that Hickman has sort of revisited this with Reed. Next is Madame Xanadu, number 14, written by Matt Wagner and drawn by Michael William Kaluta. This is the penultimate installment in the Spanish Inquisition / 1940s New York arc, and it does connect the two eras This is kind of the Madame Xanadu draws everybody into the parlor and explains what's going on, except without the parlor and without everybody being present. But it's about the same as last issue was. I did think that the plot device that allows Madame Xanadu to see the past was a little convenient. I also thought that the scenes in the Inquisition where the Inquisitors catch up to one of our cast were rather predictable. Kind of in the, you know, anytime you see a preacher on TV, he's going to be corrupt sort of thing. But, you know, it's been entertaining so far, and looking forward to the conclusion next issue. Next is Gotham City Sirens number 3, and this was a surprise to me. I was expecting this to wrap up the Harley Quinn, Tommy Elliot kidnap plot from last issue, but this is actually a good old fill-in, something that you don't really see a whole lot of in modern day comics because the publishers, I think, are more comfortable with just letting the books ship a month late. But for whatever reason, this issue was written by Scott Lobdell and drawn by the regular artist Guillaume March, and it focuses on the Riddler, who was last seen in the first issue under the thrall of Poison Ivy. And the Harley and Hush subplot is only referenced at the very beginning with a brief cameo from Catwoman, well, and Poison Ivy, who the Riddler has no love for. But this is very much in the vein of Paul Dini's Riddler spotlights from the Detective Comics from when he was writing Detective. Batman shows up kind of to play off the Riddler, who's gone straight, if you've forgotten. And it's a fun little story, you know, as these tend to be. The Riddler is kind of playing the consulting detective role, only this time the villains du jour are admirers of his, so it's fine. I don't know what happened to Paul Dini, and I'll be interested to find out. But let me see here if Lobdell is... Yeah, Scott Lobdell is not even listed as a guest writer. So, rather interesting there. We have reached the two-thirds point with Wednesday Comics number 8. And this week I thought the standouts were Commandy, as usual. But also Supergirl, the Flash strip, the Wonder Woman strip, which is... starting to finish strong, and Green Lantern. Especially like the Supergirl strip, because you'll remember that Supergirl has been trying to find out what's causing her super pets to, well, to go wild, as it were. So she goes to Dr. Midnight, who, as per usual, is in full costume. But I'm letting that slide this week because Crypto and Streaky end up chasing Dr. Midnight's owl, Hootie. That's Hootie the owl, not Hootie the blowfish. Oh, I hate myself for making that reference. But, so I thought that was eminently appropriate. I think the art in Green Lantern, Joe Quinones' art, is getting a little away from the Darwin Cook mold and in a little more, excuse me, cartoony place. But I enjoyed it because it was a good dose of action. I liked the Flash strip because it brought together a lot of the plot elements, sort of helped make everything a bit clearer, and it ended on a pretty pretty intense cliffhanger. And I always like the Commandy strip. I think that's going to end up being the headliner here. And the Wonder Woman strip brings in some Norse mythology, which is always it's always nice to see Wonder Woman branching out into the other pantheons, and indeed we'll see a little bit of that in the Wonder Woman comic this week. But we're not there yet. We're moving on to the Superman books, and specifically the end of Codename Patriot in Superman number 691, written by James Robinson, penciled by Renato Guedes, and inked by, watch me as I totally screw up these guys' names. Penciled by Renato Guedes with Eduardo Pensica, and then inked by Jose Wilson Magalhães with Sandro Ribeiro. So, sorry guys. I liked your art. I can't say your names. I did like the conclusion of Codename Patriot because it's something that doesn't end neatly. Let's say that. It doesn't end particularly well for anybody, and it sets a very disturbing status quo for the rest of the new Krypton story arc. It is essentially a series of fight scenes, which of course Guedes and Miguel Hayes have been doing pretty much since they got on Superman. So they're very dynamic. It's Mon-El versus a Supergirl imposter, Superman versus Raldar, the Army versus Superman, that kind of thing. And it's, as I say, it's an issue that leaves a pretty bitter taste in your mouth. Even more so because it facilitates the Jimmy Olsen special, which was also written by Robinson and drawn by Bernard Chang, which essentially is a double-sized issue where Jimmy is running from Codename Assassin, not to be confused with Codename Patriot. And it's pretty much actually brings another DC Universe superhero who's not, strictly speaking, part of the Superman family into the mix. But it's pretty suspenseful. It again does not end well, which I was really not expecting. So, getting a kick out of where the Superman books are right now. Of course, I like Bernard Chang's work on Wonder Woman. Here he does, his work is very similar, I think, to Guedes and also Dustin Nguyen on Streets of Gotham, formerly on Detective Comics. I don't want to say it's stylized. It is kind of stylized, but it's also very naturalistic and moody. And I suppose I ought to give a lot of the credit for the mood to the colorist, who is Mike Thomas. So, a lot of suspense going on in the Superman books. Lots of cliffhangers. That's not the best segue into Flash Rebirth number 4, but it'll have to do. And the Flash Rebirth number 4 was written by Jeff Johns and drawn by Ethan Van Sciver. And if you read, I didn't necessarily agree with the people who said that Flash Rebirth was essentially the same comic book as Green Lantern Rebirth. But with this issue, I really see what they're talking about, because it does have a lot of the same structure. This is the issue where we find out who's behind, well, we already kind of know who's behind what's been happening to Barry. This is the issue where he explains it all. It did remind me an awful lot of the issue of Green Lantern Rebirth, where the whole nature of the rings and their relationship to willpower and fear is laid out, because it's pretty much the same thing. I mean, it's not the same thing in terms of mechanics, but it's the same sort of metaphysical pseudoscience, marriage of metaphysics and pseudoscience that Johns brought to Green Lantern Rebirth. And it ends, of course, with Barry marshaling all of the flashes he can find to administer a beatdown to Professor Zoom. Not much more to say about it than that. I mean, other than my continuing frustration with Van Sciver's work, I think, you know, this has a lot of this has a lot of action in the issue. Obviously a lot of running, a lot of motion, and Van Sciver is better at that than he has been. But he still manages to draw figures. You know, when he wants to do a big splash page of a Flash or, you know, a super speedster striking a dramatic pose, it just looks unnatural. It looks too posed. Even, you know, I've criticized Dan Jurgens' figures before because they look too stiff. They don't look like they move naturally. And Van Sciver tends to do the same thing, especially when he's going for the big pin-up moment. You know, there are a few, there are a handful of full-page shots of, say, Wally West or another super speedster charging off or, as I said, posing dramatically. And you're just like, come on, dude, you know, we get it. I think Van Sciver's heart is in the right place, but I think he tries too hard. So this was a good issue in terms of advancing the plot and laying out sort of Johns' mission statement for Barry Allen. I don't fault it for that. I just think the art is not the best match for The Flash. Next up is Blackest Night Titans number one. This is the third in this particular round of Blackest Night tie-in miniseries. It is written by J.T. Kroll and penciled by Ed Bennis and inked by a bullpen including Rob Hunter, John Sibal, and J.P. Meyer. And essentially, it's Hawk and Dove, Beast Boy, and Donna Troy encountering Black Lanterns, who are people that they've loved. And Donna, that doesn't quite happen this issue, but it's coming. And that plays out about as well as you'd expect. It was not a particularly remarkable issue. It wasn't as fun as the Blackest Night Superman number one from last week, but I suppose it's not as bad as it could have been, given that there are, as DC is now fond of reminding us, there are so many dead Teen Titans. You know, it's almost literally a morbid joke to publish something like this. I mean, I guess I should say something about the art. It's not as bad as it could have been. It's actually, Ed Bennis' work, I think, here is actually a little bit better than his Justice League stuff was. It's pretty well choreographed. He has a lot fewer characters to work with in any particular scene, which I think helps. And he goes a little light on people just standing around, the script goes light on people just standing around talking to each other, which again was unfortunately a lot of what he had to draw in Justice League. But so it's okay for that. I didn't really look at it in terms of TNA, which is how I tended to look at his Justice League work, just because you couldn't avoid looking at it that way. But, I don't know. So, Wonder Woman number 35, the second part of the extremely fun Diana and Black Canary go to Japan for the Ultimate Fighting cage match storyline. In this issue, Wonder Woman fights the daughter of the Hawaiian, I can't remember off the top of my head, Hawaiian deity to whom she'd pledged her obedience or her allegiance way back last year, I think, when she was getting ready to fight the devil. And it's more of, it's a good mix of wacky fun. I really, speaking of good and bad fits for artists, I really do think that Aaron Lopresti is a good fit for this book. He gets to draw a lot of sexy women, a lot of fighting, but he manages not to make it look gratuitous. He makes it look, well, as classy as it can be. And how does this issue end? Oh, I know how it ends. So yeah, it's you know, Wonder Woman ends up fighting someone who is not on the scheduled cage match lineup, but and ends up defeating them in a non-physical manner, which is always nice to see. And I can't say too much more about this issue because I did really like it. It is about as good as last issue was, and last issue was pretty darn good. And I didn't mention who wrote it. Gail Simone wrote it, of course. And Aaron Lopresti penciled it, and Matt Ryan inked it. Next up is Green Lantern number 45, written by Jeff Johns, penciled by Doug Monkey, and inked by Christian Alamy. This, as the cover would indicate, is a big throwdown between the Sinestro Corps and the Star Sapphire Corps, led, of course, by Sinestro and Star Sapphire. And that's fun. Hal Jordan's not really in this issue, but John Stewart is. John has to deal with the Black Lantern-fied planet of Zanshi, which, if you had not been paying attention, was destroyed through John's inaction. Actually, I think, if I remember correctly, John had a bit of hubris, which ended up destroying Zanshi almost 20 years ago, probably over 20 years ago, in a miniseries written by Jim Starlin and drawn by Mike Mignola called Cosmic Odyssey. But I think Jeff Johns and others have been referring to Zanshi on and off since then, so it's probably more commonly known than I think it is. At any rate, it all looks good, thanks to Monkey and Alamy, of course. And man, they do a good job. This two-page spread where Star Sapphire is fighting some Sinestro Corps foot soldiers. It's just, I mean, they managed to make her new boob-hugging get-up look somewhat tasteful. And that's an accomplishment. I'm really enjoying their art. They draw a good Sinestro. In fact, their full-page spread of Sinestro here manages to look a lot like an Ethan Van Sciver Sinestro, except more limber and able to move a lot better than I suspect a Van Sciver drawn Sinestro would. So here's hoping that, you know, if they get on the Flash ongoing, that would be excellent. That would satisfy the Ethan Van Sciver people, and it would make me happy as well. So Sinestro and Carol Ferris, Star Sapphire, have a good full and frank discussion about her feelings about Hal. That was nice to hear. If you remember when I was talking about her story in the Tales of the Corps miniseries, I was a little worried that John's sort of shoving them back together. But this issue makes clear that that's not going to happen. And also explains how Carol feels about that. So there's a lot going on. I guess my one complaint with this issue is that it is not a good standalone issue. I think a reader who picked this up off of the shelf, despite its really fantastic cover, which has no Green Lanterns on it, actually, but someone who just picked this off the shelf would be completely lost as to what's going on. But, I mean, it's got a big Blackest Night banner on it, so Not like he couldn't find out. Next up, Detective Comics number 856, written by Greg Rucka. I should say the lead feature written by Greg Rucka and drawn by J.H. Williams III. And I think if you don't count last issue, Williams almost introduces yet another drawing style here, that being a kind of Dan Brereton sort of, what would you call it? Chalky, thick-lined, werewolf horror movie style to go along with kind of the Baroque Alice style and the two Batwoman, or the Batwoman and the Kate Kane styles. I think the conventional wisdom on this book is that J.H. Williams makes Greg Rucka's script look really, really fantastic. And I can't really disagree with that. But this, it opens up with a nice action sequence where Batwoman is rescued from the, actually from a group that goes back to Rucka's earliest work on Detective Comics. I think, you know, if you're only going to read one DC book the rest of your life, you do a lot worse than reading Detective Comics, because sooner or later, everything, I bet 60% of everything that DC publishes goes through Detective somehow. At any rate, starts off with that sequence, moves on to a dinner party, or excuse me, to a cocktail party, where we get reacquainted with Betty Kane, who long-time Teen Titans fans will recognize as Batwoman's traditional sidekick, Flamebird. We're not sure if they're still sidekicks here. Kate also gets to dance with Maggie Sawyer, who's DC's one of DC's other high-profile lesbians. And I like Maggie. She and Kate make a good couple. And it all sets up the cliffhanger of this issue. So, boy howdy, yet another good issue from Rucka and Williams. The co-feature is The Question, which is written by Rucka and drawn by Cully Hamner. It's kind of hard to describe because Question either is being beaten up or doing the beating, but it's fine. I think somebody else online described the Question feature as sort of a 70s cop show with Renee Montoya, the Question, in the Jim Rockford role. Although the Question could probably put a pretty good beating on Rockford. And finally, it's Batman and Robin number 3, written by Grant Morrison and drawn by Frank Quitely. And boy, it is a thrill ride. I hate to sound like a cliche generator, but the whole issue is pretty much one continuous fight sequence with a couple of a few pages taken out here and there for some character moments and some setup for the next story arc. But it is just, you know, poetry in motion. Quietly draws a couple of pages of Robin tearing into Professor Pig's minions that are just insane in their detail and their choreography. And he does an excellent job with Pig as well, who is sort of an... I have a hard time still kind of putting Pig's personality into simple terms, but I would say that he's intended at the very least to be just the psychotic nut bar that that every good Batman villain is at heart, except Pig is sort of kind of crazy for crazy's sake, not even crazy with style like the Joker. And Batman, Dick as Batman, is, I suppose, is meant to come into his own in this issue. Has a couple of conversations with Commissioner Gordon about you know, don't worry, I can do the job kinds of things. There is one scene early on where the issue opens with Batman aggressively interrogating the dude who bursts into flame, and he drags him along, hangs him out of the Batmobile and sort of drags him along the pavement. And Gordon's like, you know, I leave you alone for 2 minutes and this is what you do with the guy. And Gordon says, who do you think you are? And Batman, of course, says, I am Batman. And I'm like, well, yeah, you let the original Batman do all this stuff. Why are you, you know, getting up in the new Batman's grill? Maybe this is a reaction. I doubt it's this, but putting on my continuity cop hat here, maybe Gordon is remembering the Azrael Batman of the 90s who, you know, all didn't play by the rules and that kind of thing. But I digress. A great end to the first story arc, the Professor Pig story arc. Real showcase for Frank Quitely with his work on Robin and Pig. And an excellent setup for the Red Hood arc, which is beginning next issue. And also a nice little bit of closure from Batman RIP as Batman and Robin take care of some business from remaining from that arc. And a nice visual, too, as they do that, of the Batmobile's headlights lighting up the bad guy's headquarters with a bat signal. So, I'll never turn down gratuitous use of the bat signal. And with that, we bring another installment of this podcast to a close. Thanks for listening. Thanks for putting up with my lingering respiratory issues. And I will talk to you later.